Hello, pals. I hope that you are safe, well, happy, merry, and if you are in the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland, and frankly, most of Western Europe, and broadly speaking, the world as a whole, somewhere shady, cool, and with a refreshing and hydrating cocktail in your hand. Don't know if you've heard, but there's a bit of a heat wave on. I am currently speaking to you from what most people would describe as a Swedish sauna, but is actually my kitchen. Just so you know, we'll be covering a bit more of this nonsense with comedian and proper environmental academic Dr. Matt Winning in about a month's time. So I don't want to dwell on it too much because we're going to talk about it a lot in a show, and also because it's a little bit scary and depressing. So, to business. What could be less scary and depressing than the climate catastrophe, than the rise of nationalism? Because that's pretty much the tale of this week's episode. And we have a Patreon supporter to thank for it. So a big salute and shout out to Joe Kernan, who brought us an enormous list of suggestions, which included the world's worst artistic fall from grace, the world's worst country and western song, all of them. But we ultimately, that's unfair to the world of country and western. There's at least three good ones. But ultimately, we went for the world's worst national myth, which we are very happy indeed with. So we hope you enjoy the show. As ever, if you want to join Joe in nominating a topic for us, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward, chuck us a fiver a month, and you can choose a topic for us to natter on about. And you can choose a topic for us to research for your own entertainment. Otherwise, as ever, if you want to get in touch, you can do it on @worstfoot. I'm on @BenVanderveld. He is on @BazMcStay. And together you can email us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Last of all, as ever, if you want to keep the show popular and appearing in interesting places for more human beings to enjoy, you can leave us a review on the podcatcher of your choice. 5 stars is absolutely the only review that you're allowed to leave. 1 star would be on brand for this podcast. Oh, I don't know, celebrating heroic failure? I don't know, that probably feels like a 2-star review. A 2-star that reads like a 5. But you know what? Don't do that. Leave us a 5 that reads as a 2. That's a better way of doing it. I think that completes all of our admin. So please join us hop, skipping and goose-stepping towards this week's episode on the world's worst national myth. Welcome, citizens, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you join us as we clutch a shield to our breasts, hoist our flag into the air, and proudly sing all 27 verses of the Worst Foot Forward anthem, even the problematic ones that should have been edited out years ago. It's time to talk origin stories, and I'm sure after over 250 episodes, you're delighted to hear ours. Myself and Barry were found dumped in a wheelie bin by a pair of urban foxes. They nursed us, reared us, suckled us, and then, in a moment of divine revelatory clarity, said, "What the hell are we doing? We're foxes. This is weird. Get out." And to be fair, we have to admit, fox milk is pretty grim. Nevertheless, inspired by our step-parents, we went out into the world to create the Worst Fox Forward podcast. Our adoptive parents found this incredibly offensive, and we now find ourselves pariahs of the Renard community. We were relieved when we found out fox hunting was being made illegal, as we thought that meant the foxes hunting us would be made illegal. Turns out, we are still fair game. So, before we get ripped to shreds by ginger vermin, I'd best introduce my co-host, the lady to my liberty, the rule to my Britannia, and the dragon to my St. George. It's Barry McStay.
I thought this was going to build to a point where we were sort of made to fight each other naked in the middle of a circle of foxes somewhere for the right to found the city of not Rome.
gosh. Yeah, sure. If you want to pen that fan fiction, then you are very welcome to.
It probably has been already.
Yeah. Well, that's because I know that you, like me, are a big fan of computer god games like Age of Empires and Civilization. And I always enjoyed founding cities with new versions of my name. So there was quite a lot of Vandervilles and Vandistans.
I always enjoyed the early stages of those games when you're going, oh, I've got a little hut by a river, and oh, I'm starting to cut some trees down, or I'm starting to expand. It's the latter stages where you're basically a city manager, and it begins to lose its fun when you're like, oh, there's a leak. got to get the plumbers down to that area. Got to negotiate with these people over grain quotas. it's not so fun anymore.
That's the thing. Like, also, you know, traditionally Football Manager is the computer game that takes over a young man's life when he's a teenager. But it's all right to be sat there going, darling, what's wrong? You've not touched your Weetabix. I'm just wondering whether I should have overlapping wingbacks in my 4-3-3. It's different if your mum goes, darling, you're not touching a Weetabix. What's wrong? It's just like, I've got a diplomatic meeting with the Hittites at 2 p.m. and I'm nervous it's going to go badly.
But to be fair, what's it called? We've talked, I think, on the pod before about Animal Crossing, the video game, which came out during lockdown, and how it gave everybody who had a Nintendo Switch at the time the chance to feel a little bit of control in a world gone mad. When we were all locked away, and suddenly you had a little island and you could build some houses and, you know, decide you wanted to put a flamingo ornament on the lawn of your house, or shall I harvest the pears today? And but at the dark heart of it, you're still in hock to the evil Tom Nook, this character who you're randomly giving increasing amounts of money to every so often. He goes, do you want another room in your house? You got to pay me 200,000 bells. So capitalism, even at the heart of it, still managed to eat away at you.
I've never played that game, but the impression that I got is that it was the Island of Dr. Moreau, but for 6-year-olds.
Anyway, let's talk less horrifying things. Our guest this week is a writer and journalist whose work appears frequently in Politico and the Byline Times, as well as his own blog, The Pinprick, under the mission statement, to serve, to mock, to annoy, which could just as well be a Tory party campaign slogan these days. Having originally written for both TV and theatre, he moved into history and politics, and his non-fiction book, Fake History, was published in 2021, looking at the 10 biggest lies in history and the people who propagated them. A book about historical mistakes, you say? What a niche idea. Hopefully there's room in the market for at least two of those. His work is under a pen name, which he came up with on the spot prior to an appearance on television, as he shares a real name with Andrew Scott, the actor who plays Moriarty in Sherlock. And there's really only room on this podcast for one devastatingly handsome homosexual Irish actor. So stay in your lane. Please welcome the excellent Englishman, Otto English.
Thank you very much for having me. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. I first of all, Otto English, just a good name on the spot, or is there like an origin story?
There's a part of the story that's slightly missing out in my origin story there, which is that back in the early 2000s, in the early days of Twitter, I was one of those fake Twitter accounts that fooled the world. I adopted the persona of a man called Jacob Rees-Mogg. And my neighbour Polly still holds Jacob Rees-Mogg's rise to account to me ever since, because I was so good at pretending to be Jacob Rees-Mogg that tens of thousands of people started following the Twitter account. And he started getting invited onto all sorts of programs, including Newsnight, where he was told that they loved his blog and his tweets, only for him to say, I don't blog or tweet.
Yeah. Unless by tweet you mean carrier pigeon.
Well, exactly. So I kept it very sort of believable. That was the problem. And so at some point, I think it was 2010, the BBC invited me on to meet him. But I was very wary because he had a history of threatening people with legal action who had impersonated him. So I made the name up on the spot, pretty much. And then I kept it because of the whole Andrew Scott thing, which had annoyed me because I too had once briefly been an actor. People kept going, oh, you really should register your name with equity. And I was like, no, it'll be fine.
I mean, very embarrassingly for me, Ben Vanderveld is actually a stage name, and my real name is Otto English. But
oh, I thought you were gonna, I thought you were going to say it was Benedict Cumberbatch. And yeah. We hit the gold mine here. Well, so evidently, Otto, you're very good at penning new identities for yourself, be they online or in print. What are you less good at? What are you worst at in the world?
Do you know, I've got this terrible tendency to befriend my enemies. And I...
Wittingly or unwittingly?
Well, I think about it often. So online, you know, behind the screen of anonymity and firing away angrily at people, I'm quite good at holding people to account and writing nasty things about people. But put me in a room with them and I sort of find myself sort of trying to warm to them. And it's happened throughout my life to some extent. It is a real human weakness. And for example, during the UKIP years and subsequently several, I mean, I am friendly with somebody who was a key player in UKIP, partly because I ended up in the pub with him once. And
just for our non-British listeners, UKIP were a political party who were very anti-immigration, anti-European, etc.
So I worry about that sometimes. I worry that if I was sitting down for tea with Mussolini or something, I'd sort of start laughing along to his jokes. So it's a very great personal weakness and one that I'm aware of. I think it might be from the theatre stuff. You know, you have to think of character motivation. So I start trying to think, why does that person operate and think like that? And I start looking for something sympathetic within that person's backstory. And I, you know, even when I was writing about Hitler in the book, I started thinking, oh, well, he had a terrible childhood and things like this. And I think it's really important to try and stop yourself and go, hold on. You can't just excuse somebody for every ghastly thing they've done. So that is my greatest perceived professional weakness.
I get that as well. I don't like conflict. I'm a great compromiser. And partially from performing, but also before I was a stand-up, I used to work as a charity fundraiser on the street. And the big thing we were told for building rapport is, yeah, find something in common, see something from the other person's point of view. And sometimes you do have to befriend people whose points of view you disagree with. And it's a good thing, because you look at, to take the example of Hitler, genuinely very brave during World War One, would have preferred it if he hadn't come out the other side alive. Yeah. But you
what a shame Hitler never won the Iron Cross.
Yeah.
he did. Hitler did win the Iron.
Oh, did he? Posthumously.
But you see, bravery itself is, I mean, if you look into Hitler, I mean, I, in preparation for my book, I read Mein Kampf. In a translation by an Irish author, actually, from the 1940s. Mm. And the actually, if you read Mein Kampf, it cures you of any sympathy for Hitler, because he comes across as a totally unhinged, but very sort of spoilt and petulant dickhead. Now, I mean, that might seem a bit obvious to say, but as I say, I think as I say in the book, he's the kind of guy who kind of is banging on about how he failed his SATs when he's 52, you know.
Well, it's interesting. I saw a brilliant bit of writing advice from, I think it was Lisa Holdsworth, popped it on Twitter, about to make a good antagonist, they should believe they are the hero. Which in theatre or film or TV, that's great. And I think there may be some thoroughly evil world leaders like that, but yeah, one of the secrets of Hitler is, yeah, how banal and spoiled he was. But I am genuinely someone who believes he could, I wouldn't want to break bread with everyone, but I'm really good at rapport, so honestly, if he didn't know what my family's ethnicity was, I reckon me and Adolf could sit down and have a nice chat about watercolors for 5 minutes.
Ben would have accepted a corporate at the Eagle's Nest with absolutely no no compunction whatsoever.
If they're willing to play me in gold bullion, so long as they file off the eagle and swastika insignia beforehand, I will take it.
what is a nation? That's what we're going to start with. And specifically, I'm going to look at the lecture from 1882 by the French historian Ernest Renan, which is titled What is a Nation? He gave this lecture at the University of Sorbonne. Now, obviously, preface to this, Renan was a late 19th century French historian with troubling views on race and the Jews. Mussolini was a fan. He felt that Renan felt that democracy wasn't helpful and individual rights were counter to nature's plan. So just putting all of that, we've got a Victorian historian in the building. Yeah. but he does say some really interesting stuff about nationhood and how nations are founded and things like that. He describes nations as a daily referendum, which is quite an interesting way of putting it.
I mean, it is, but considering what happened with our once-in-a-generation referendum, daily ones sound horrifying.
But, well, yeah, try Switzerland, where they have to have referendums on practically everything for any laws to get passed in Switzerland. Yeah, he says, a nation is a soul, a spiritual principle. Two things which, properly speaking, are really one and the same constitute this soul. One is the past, the other is the present. One is the possession in common of a rich legacy of memories. The other is present consent, the desire to live together, the desire to continue to invest in the heritage that we have jointly received. Of all cults, that of the ancestors is the most legitimate. Our ancestors have made us what we are. Which I think is, you know, this idea of where we've come from and how, you know, our forefathers and the struggle to create our nation and all those stories we tell ourselves. Those are the things that people still cling to today in trying to define nationhood an awful lot. And he, you know, he says that you can't build a nation necessarily on race. He sort of gives the example of France, which is a mixture of, you know, Celts and Iberians and Germans, and the same with England and Italy. A lot of those, the great nations at the time he was giving this lecture, are already hugely intermingled and a melting pots of different countries and cultures and so on. He says language isn't the basis for national unity. It invites us but does not force us to unite. Which I quite like. And he actually mentions Switzerland, obviously a country with, you know, four national languages and all sorts of, you know, different dialects and so on. Again, religion, he doesn't say, is a particularly useful way to build a nation. And geography isn't one either. He says mountains don't know how to carve our countries, which is a nice way of putting it. But he said the thing I was most interested in is he says that forgetfulness and I would even say historical error are essential in the creation of a nation, which leads us quite nicely into national myth. The idea that you have to ignore certain historical truths, otherwise, he says, almost historical research can endanger nationhood. And we saw that with, you know, the backlash against people tearing down statues of slavers, how people were like, no, we must keep these statues up because they were there and they're of people from our past, rather than, or the idea that cultural institutions shouldn't examine all parts of how they came to have such nice paintings or whatever.
Can I just pick up on that? Colston,
yes.
That actually fascinates me because the Conservatives started trotting out their, all the people defending statues trotted out their statues are a way we can learn about history. If you tear down the statues, then people won't understand history. Well, I wonder how many people in the UK outside of Bristol had ever heard of Edward Colston until that statue was pulled down. The act of pulling the statue down made Edward Colston's name and story resonate in a way that it had never done outside Bristol and Bath for, you know, 200 years. And so the stories, I mean, that idea is complete nonsense.
Yeah. Well, no, it was proper Streisand effect. If they'd sort of, you know, let it be, not really talked about it, one would have gone, wait, we've got loads of statues of racists and slavers around the country. Yeah. But again, you sort of go, okay, well, let's keep it up, but let's put it in its historical context and let's add a plaque explaining exactly how he made his money, or let's explain how this beautiful country house was built on the back of the sugar trade and the Atlantic slave trade, and they don't want that either. How can we learn about history if we don't leave these places up? No, not that history, just the nice bit of history with the gift shop and the tea.
That's what they mean. They mean their version of history is what I called ladybird libertarianism. It's the idea that everything in the ladybird book is a bit like what we were talking about Richard the Lionheart briefly. It's like everything in the ladybird book happened, and if you dare question it or say that it doesn't matter, then you somehow hate this country.
Yeah, I think when people enter the United Kingdom, there should be a little sign saying, "Welcome to Britain," ignoring context since 1066. The statues thing is fascinating. I was in Parliament Square a few weeks ago, and looking at the statues, it was fascinating seeing who is and isn't there. Ignoring the controversy around Churchill, Jan Smuts, who is an unbelievably racist man who was key to the formation of South Africa, is there, and also Nelson Mandela and Gandhi. And it sort of feels like what they've done, they've turned it into a weird pantheon where they've gone, oh, well, you managed to outsmart us and get independence. Do you get true equality? No, but you do get a statue.
Right at the back. It's the sort of Madame Tussauds of statues, isn't it? It's Smuts is the Chamber of Horrors, and the others are some of the greatest hits. Very strange.
So this idea, it's sort of similar to Plato's idea of the noble lie, a sort of a lie spread by the elite to maintain a sort of sense of a social harmony and cohesion and stuff like that, which. I guess we're all going to touch on in our research. I read quickly about the formation and the founding myths of a couple of failed nations.
Great.
We love a failed micronation or a libertarian paradise on this show. The Atlantis Project. Have you heard of that one, Ben?
Oh, I feel like we've talked about that before on the show. Is that a bunch of libertarians trying to claim some atolls as their new home?
Yeah, it's one of those. There's several of those if we go diving deep enough. This was founded by a guy called Eric Klein, a Las Vegas software engineer who made a lot of money playing the stock market, was able to retire at the age of 25, and became involved with the libertarian movement. He was a bit annoyed that a libertarian candidate didn't win a state senate election in 1993. And they claimed that election fraud was involved in the fact that their candidate didn't win. And so he and a group of like-minded anti-government activists decided that they were going to found an organization called the Atlantis Project with the goal of constructing a floating island nation off the coast of Panama, which they would name Oceania, which is the name of the dystopian state in 1984. Yeah. And they described it would be a peaceful dolphin compared to the shark-like US government.
Funny he should have picked Atlantis, because you know the Nazis believed that they were descendants of the people of Atlantis, which is a pretty... I didn't pick that one myself, but that's a pretty bonkers origin. Hitler sent out archaeologists to prove this palpably stupid idea. And they started make up all sorts of archaeology to prove it. So to pick Atlantis is a weird one in the first place.
It is. Yeah. I had a quick look at the propensity of Arianism, which obviously the Nazis were obsessed with Arians. But there was this huge notion around the formation of Germany from 1871 to about 1900 that they didn't want to be a Christian nation, they wanted to be a pagan nation, and they wanted to relate themselves back to pre-Christian Europe. So the connection to the notion that all Europeans were descended from these white-skinned, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people who were from India for some reason. But they also, it's not a particularly large leap from paganism to occultism. And obviously that was all floating around in the late Victorian era as well. So my first connection to this was in Hellboy, never mind Indiana Jones. And things that I thought were just comic book nonsense turned to have out some real foundation in reality. Because the other thing that Hitler was apparently quite obsessed with, gosh, and this is a plot from Hellboy, but I'm pretty certain it's true, was the spear that pierced the side of Christ.
The Lance of Longinus, it's called, yeah. Which a friend of the show, Paul Duncan McGarty, insists should be the MacGuffin of the next Indiana Jones movie.
That was a good idea.
Yeah. To round off the Atlantis Project, they did a crowdfunding campaign, raising $100,000 to try and found this state. a Swedish architect drew a Swedish architect built a scale model of their island nation, and they drew up a constitution which included things like noting that government aid and charities were compassionate gunpoint. All elections would include an option to vote for the removal of an office entirely from the government, and that hospitals would have the right to turn off life support if patients could no longer afford healthcare.
Oh, lovely.
Jesus America, Christ.
Basically. Yeah, so they, America, but more so, I seem to be the goal here.
Whenever I think about these libertarians setting up their little island states, all I can think of is Peter from Family Guy setting up a cushion fort and then putting a sign outside saying no girls.
Yeah. and one more origin story that I quite liked was the failed invasion of Dominica by the Ku Klux Klan.
What?
1981, the KKK were having a rough time of it, so to speak. They had very low membership and their funds were running dry, and the US government were cracking down pretty hard on them. So a bunch of Klansmen teamed up with some Canadian neo-Nazis with the goal of trying to conquer a Caribbean island and form their own nation. And they thought initially they'd pick Grenada, because Grenada had a socialist government at the time, so they thought the USA actually wouldn't really care that a socialist government had been overthrown. But then the Prime Minister of Dominica was forced to step down. He wanted to regain power. This Prime Minister, Patrick John, was his name. And he would go to any lengths to regain power, including teaming up with the KKK. Patrick John was associated with the Dreads, an extremist Rastafarian group who lived in Dominica, in the sort of the mountainous center of the country. And so the white supremacists and the Pan-Africanists decided to come together to try and conquer Dominica. And the KKK had the plan. They were going to pretend to be CIA agents, board a boat in New Orleans, sail to Dominica, work with the Dreads, overthrow the government, install John as a figurehead, and then the Klan would set up gun running and cocaine smuggling businesses and stuff, and then they would dispose of the Dreads and so on, and eventually Dominica would become a safe haven for their Aryan friends. Obviously Dominica has an overwhelmingly black population, so I don't know how the idea would have gone down. They never got it off the ground, as it turned out, because they got together in New Orleans with a group all, you know, with swastika tattoos, which gives the CIA cover story a little less credence. and their grand invasion army totaled 10 people.
Oh.
So they never got off the ground. They were arrested. But I quite liked the pluck they demonstrated.
Yes, the pluck of the brave Nazi. Yes.
The brave Nazi, yeah.
Have you seen Birth of a Nation, the film which gave birth to the KKK outfits?
The D.W. Griffith film, yeah. No, we've talked about it in the past, yeah.
During lockdown, I, again, at my son's behest, watched it, because he said, you've got to see this because it is the most jaw-dropping thing you will ever see. And it really is. The first half of the film is kind of vaguely sensible. Lincoln gets assassinated. And then the KKK try and sort of put the genie of equality back in the box. They're portrayed as sort of heroic cowboys riding to the rescue of white maidens against the black America. It is the most extraordinary thing. But that was how those KKK outfits and the burning crosses.
Yeah.
Griffiths did it. It wasn't something that America was doing previously.
Yeah, and then you know, between that and you ordering a copy of Mein Kampf, your internet search history is beginning to have doubts about you, I suspect.
I'm happy to say that I didn't actually buy it.
Good.
Read Mein Kampf as a PDF online. I wasn't going to make that.
Yeah, that's true. But my worst national myth is I'm going to talk about the foundation of the Republic of Ireland. And obviously there's lots of national myths around Ireland, you know, St. Patrick being this iconic Irish figure when he was probably Welsh or French. The shamrock is a symbol of Ireland, and that's basically used as a teaching aid for Christians, is to demonstrate how the Holy Trinity could exist. It's one thing but three things in one. And you know, there's the Irish warrior spirit story, which is based on Celtic myth, so a lot of post-colonial nations have the whole punching above our weight, fighting it's self-image, which they quite like, and the whole idea of being poets and artists and things like that as well, and you know, the myth of Ireland. And actually a lot of that is drawn from the Celtic revival of the late 19th century, which was reviving the idea of Celtic mysticism throughout all of Europe. So Ireland just ended up being caught up in a lot of that. The thing I focused on is the story of how the Republic of Ireland came to be formed. So Ireland was, you know, part of the United Kingdom up until 1921, where we became a free state, but still part of the Commonwealth and still with the crown mentioned in the Constitution and some of our diplomatic relations, and specifically in our diplomatic relations. We passed a law called the External Relations Act in 1936, which got rid of the mention of the crown from everything apart from our diplomatic links with other countries. So it meant that our senior diplomats had to be accredited to and by the British monarch, and vice versa. If people were coming to be ambassadors to Ireland, they were at the behest of the crown.
So you still had to ask permission from mummy even though you'd left?
Yes, via the Court of St. James, yeah. And so we had a situation, one example, where our ambassador to the Vatican had to have a letter of credence written in Irish, addressed to the Pope, but signed by King George VI.
Oh, my goodness.
And so the king, to his credit, deleted the title Defender of the Faith from his list of titles, which is a title given by the Vatican to Henry VIII before Henry VIII then created the schism in the Anglican Church. Then the Pope sent a diplomatic note of thanks to the king for appointing the envoy. And in 1947, the Irish ambassador to the Vatican, Joe Walsh, was kept waiting in Rome for 3 weeks to have his credentials signed by the king, because things were having to go via all these various, you know, from the Pope to Ireland and then to the king. And and Éamon de Valera, who was the Irish Prime Minister of the Taoiseach at the time, was not thrilled. So they started work on a bill to repeal the External Relations Act, which meant basically getting rid of the link to the crown as well. It didn't mention the idea of us actually becoming a full republic at the time, although Ireland did have a president and its own constitution at this time, but we were still the Irish Free State. Eventually, this draft of this bill included a reference to the state as a republic, and part of the Irish foundation myth is that we read a proclamation of a republic during the 1916 Rising, and that idea of the republic originates from them. Although, sidebar, the 1916 Rising is the big, you know, the big 20th century origin myth. The Easter Rising is a big sort of military myth that we like to cling to as the moment that the state was founded and who the heroes emerged from. And actually at the time, it was a hugely unpopular uprising. The leaders of the 1916 Rising had fruit and vegetable thrown at themselves as they were arrested, because they'd, you know, a lot of the Dubliners felt they'd destroyed the city by bringing the British in. And, you know, World War One was happening at the time. A lot of Irish people were fighting in that. They said it was unnecessary. They thought they'd actually, and there were even, you know, people who wanted Ireland to be independent who felt that these men had been rash and had damaged the idea of us being independent. We'd actually signed a home rule bill just before World War One broke out, and the reason it hadn't been enacted is because the war had happened. But anyway, all of that aside, De Valera was replaced by John A. Costello as Taoiseach in a coalition, and there was a minor party called Clan na Publiachta who were really keen on us being a republic. And every time Costello turned his back, Sean McBride, who was the leader of Clan na Publiachta, would sort of brief the press about how the country was going to become a republic and how the External Relations Act was going to be repealed properly and all of these things, and would kind of bounce Costello into having to go further with declaring how independent the country would be. The myth that I really like in all of this is that Johnny Costello was in Canada in 1948, and Canada, like Ireland, was part of the Commonwealth. And there was a lot of pressure being put on Ireland by other Commonwealth nations saying, don't do anything to rock the boat, don't leave the Commonwealth, you'll be censured, all of these things. Costello was at a dinner, and the story is that he got drunk while sat opposite a replica of a cannon called Roaring Meg, which was used during the Siege of Derry in 1689, which was a victory for the Protestant forces against the Catholic forces. And that he got so incensed and so drunk that he walked out of the Governor General's residence and stood in front of the press and just declared that Ireland was going to become a republic there and then. And you know, in actual fact, this idea of repealing the External Relations Act had been brewing for ages, like I said. And it took him, there was a Sunday Independent headline saying that Ireland might be about to become a republic, and there was communication between Costello and McBride about whether they would or wouldn't do that. It wasn't a spur of the moment thing. What is the true is that basically Costello only talked about it with Sean McBride, the leader of this minor party, before announcing it. And then they came back and chatted about it with the cabinet and said, and the cabinet agreed to what Costello had announced in Canada. But it was the case that Costello did offer his resignation to the cabinet as well. That said, you know, this is what I think we should do. I should have consulted you.
This guy went, we're going independent, and the rest of the Irish government went, we are.
Yeah, he and it was the terms rather than anything else. It was the idea that, you know, they all knew this bill was going to happen, and they all knew we were going to delete the crown.
When the Berlin Wall fell, I can't remember the name of the guy, but you know that there were already fractures in the Iron Curtain, and yeah, people were going into Western Europe through Czechoslovakia and Hungary. Yeah. And there was a famous press conference early November 1989, where, and I think that guy was either drunk or under something had happened, and somebody in the press said, so you're saying that visas will be issued for people to go from East Germany to West Germany. Mm-hmm. When can they go? Can they go now? And the guy said, well, yes, I suppose so, because he was caught on the hop. And that was the moment that everybody started heading west and the Berlin Wall fell. It was a sort of ill-judged comment by a spokesperson for the DDR.
Yeah,
but it's funny, isn't it? Sometimes these historical events, it is an innocuous trigger.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's there was, you know, history was leading to this point, and it happened that, you know, while Costello was at this dinner and didn't get drunk or wasn't sat opposite this cannon, it is the case that the a toast to the president, there was meant to be a toast to the president of Ireland, and the governor general decided not to do that. He was an Ulsterman and a former mutineer from 1914. Costello reserved any comment about this until he met with the Canadian Prime Minister. It wasn't, you know, an immediate outburst. And similarly, there had already been cracks in the walls in terms of this diplomatic relations. Argentina, under Perón, had sent its ambassador direct to the President of Ireland rather than to the King. So countries were beginning, you know, Ireland was already beginning to move towards this. But the idea that John A. Costello got drunk and just declared a republic on the spur of the moment is not true. So it's one of the lesser known Irish national myths, but it's maybe one of the more recent ones that I think is quite interesting. Yeah. That already this story has blown up around in a time when there's a lot of documentation to say otherwise. I'm John A. Costello didn't get drunk opposite a cannon and declare a republic. That's my national myth.
One of my favourite stories of attempted but failed myth making is the story of how Australia nearly had an aristocracy. So in the 1860s and 70s, there was a man called Wentworth, who was a major player in New South Wales. And they were trying to create separate federal states within Australia, what became eventually Australia. And this guy said, well, do you know what the big problem is with this country? We don't have an aristocracy, right? So we need an aristocracy. So we need lords, ladies, earls, dukes. That's what we need. Now, the reason I tell it as the starter is because the story ends very quickly. It was known as the Bunyip aristocracy after a fictional beast that lives in Australia's outback. So it was quickly dubbed the Bunyip aristocracy by satirists, who laughed and ridiculed at the idea of the Duke of Wallamaloo or the...
I mean, the Duke of Wallamaloo is a lost Edward Lear poem.
Yeah.
Yeah, or the Lords of Tasmania. It was so widely mocked that it was laughed out of the country, and Wentworth never imposed, would have become a curious regional aristocracy entirely sprung out of nothing. And the reason I tell that story is because all notions of sort of hereditary rulers or aristocracy are fundamentally stupid ideas. If you try to do it in the modern era, people mock it and laugh at it. But because it's been there for 1,000 years or 2,000 years, people kind of go, yeah, you know, they do a wonderful job, and it's part of their thing. So instead of talking about our own royal family, which I was tempted to do, I'm going to talk about North Korea.
Yes.
So North Korea, as you know, has been the People's Republic of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, has been in existence since the end of the Second World War. And the three Kims, the grandfather, son, and grandson, who have followed, I'll call them Kim 1, 2, and 3, otherwise everyone's going to start getting twisted on their Kims. They have developed this extraordinary origin myth, which is centered around a place called Mount Paektu in Korea, which is Korea's highest mountain. And there's all these extraordinary myths about Paektu, that Paektu gives the leading people of the country sort of holy Paektu blood. So they have this holy blood, and they have this something like, which is akin to the Force. It translates, as warp. So the Kims, it was widely believed, and they propagated the idea that the Kims have the ability to fly, that they have the ability to move objects with their minds, and, you know, they're sort of Jedi masters, and that they have these extraordinary abilities. So in among those, there is the belief propagated in North Korea that Kim Tu, that's the Kim of Team America.
Yes.
Team America Kim, that he invented not only the hamburger, but also the cheeseburger.
Yeah. I love that story, but he called it, he had a different name for it, didn't he?
I actually have it written here because I can never, do you know, when you do an audiobook, top tip, if you ever do an audiobook, do not put in the name of the North Korean hamburger, because you will sit there for hours on end.
I know the English translation is double bread with meat. After the Earl of Double Bread with Meat, who wanted something to snack upon.
Wallamaloo. If you look at pictures of those restaurants that they set up, they bear a striking similarity to a chain of Scottish-named American restaurants. They've got the almost identical outfits. It's extraordinary. So though that's a series of extraordinary myths, there's also the story that Kim Tu composed North Korea's greatest operas, including, and that is why I had the book open. This is my favorite. A True Daughter of the Party is the opera, but Kim Tu wrote a book about how to write a great opera, and I'll just tell you the title of it. The book is a punchy little title. It's called Let Us Produce Revolutionary Operas That Are High in Ideological and Artistic Quality by Strictly Applying the Principle of Creating Revolutionary Operas of the Type of the Sea of Blood, 1971.
Surely he could have just gone with Revolutionary Operas for Dummies.
Yeah. Go-to text. North Korea, if you want to write your own opera. And while I was writing my book, I did actually watch True Daughter of the Party. And do you know what? The trouble was, it was a bit like what I was saying at the top of the show. I started to kind of warm to it. I was sort of tapping my foot along and thinking, this is quite good. You know, it was a bit like Les Miserables. And there was some effects. Anyway. The greatest national myth around Kim Tu is that he once played a perfect round of golf in which he got a hole in one at every single hole. But that is a myth.
Yes.
He never said that. So even as we sit and laugh at the North Korea, and this is the lesson today, if you like, even as we sit and laugh at them, which it's tempting and very easy to do, we have to bear in mind that there's also a lot of propaganda going in both directions and a lot of misinformation going in both directions. All that stuff about killing people by firing missiles at them or feeding them to rabid dogs. That's largely propaganda and disinformation. There is no evidence that that has happened beyond South Korean propaganda. So while North Korea is not some great shining beacon of a marvelous state that we should all want to go live in, has its huge problems, we create almost as many myths about it as it created about itself.
But it's sort of, it's so easy to lay those myths over them because they're, I was going to say they're such preposterous figures, and obviously who are we to say that living in the West in the year of our Lord's 2022? But perhaps unfairly on Kim too, when our generation thinks of him, we think of a 1 foot high puppet singing songs to himself. Which, I mean, listen, it's a hilarious film full of comedy genius, but it feels like the distance between Kim and his puppet is shorter than the distance between Boris Johnson and his spitting image puppet.
Yeah.
Yes, but I mean, the danger with it is that we treat them and their leadership as a joke, and the Kims have been highly effective at staying in power and holding on to that power. So even as we sort of, as I say, rightly mock it, we've got to be wary. And there was, I remember also when Kim Tu died, there were all those scenes of everybody crying in the streets and wailing and thumping their fists on the ground in the most unconvincing display, which was hugely comical until the moment when you see Diana's funeral.
Yeah.
When people are wailing loudly in the street and beating their breasts and tears streaming down their faces. Now, of course, Diana and Kim, you know, the foot-high puppet, are very far apart. But the idea that our country and our people couldn't necessarily behave in this bizarre way of an outpouring of public emotion, I think, is a dangerous one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the it's really interesting reading. I did read a little bit about this because I knew you were going to talk about it. And the Peg Two bloodline that you mentioned, the idea that they're all descended from this sacred mountain. I think Kim Il Sung, who was Kim One, if you like, the oldest Kim, he was a guerrilla soldier during this Korean War and resisting the Japanese occupation. So a lot of his resistance was against Japanese forces around that mountain. So it sort of helped amplify the fact that this already sacred mountain was at the part of the military struggle. And Kim Won very much lent into that when he took power. But then the story goes that Kim Jong-il, Kim Tu, was born on the mountain.
Yes.
And at the moment of his birth, a new star formed and illuminated the sky, and the seasons changed from winter to spring.
That's it.
It was a double rainbow.
Proper bonkers.
Yeah, and actually, the records show he was born in Russia. He was born in Siberia.
Yes, in a camp. It's proper bonkers until you remember that a lot of people believe that the royal family, until quite recently, had blue blood.
Yeah, that's true.
But I was getting...
So we all mock pick two blood, and then you go, well, what about blue blood? Oh, well, that's different.
I feel like, though, if Prince Charles ascended to the throne and said, I could move things with my mind, then as a nation, we'd be like, all right, ITV1, Saturday night, 8 p.m, Britain's Got Talent, you show us, Charlie boy.
Hosted by David Icke, going, I told you. The other thing I liked is that Kim too seemed to be like a little less insane when he took power than his dad, and he forbade the erection of forbade statues being erected. He discouraged portraits of himself, but then there was a big old famine, and things began to get a bit rocky, and so he leant back into the brainwashing vibe. He passed an edict in 1996 saying schools were required to build a separate room. All schools, a separate room for lectures specifically about him, called the Kim Jong-il Research Institute. And they would be, there'd have be a model of Mount Paektu, and there'd be stories about, you know, what an incredible leader and bloodline he came from. There's apparently 40,000 of these throughout the country now about him and his dad. And
It's a cult of personality. So, I mean, you do get that in a lot of dictatorships, but the Kims turned it up to 11, you know. In my gap year, I did that classic thing, you know, where you go to a Southeast Asian country, grow your hair long when I still could, and you know, start walking around without any shoes on. And I actually taught for a year in Indonesia in a state school. The English textbooks were all full of propaganda about the birth of the nation in 1945 and the dictator who was then living, Suharto. And it was quite similar, you know, the smiling general he was known as, and and all this kind of stuff. I used to skip those pages.
But then I imagine also as a British person teaching in a former colonial country, you'd be like, yeah, I don't really want to go any further back in history though either, guys.
Do you want a couple of other Kim propaganda stories? There was a couple I really liked. Kim Jong-il apparently was said by an unidentified French fashion expert that Kim Jong-il mode is something unprecedented in world's history, that he was a bit of a fashion icon and that people around the world were wearing his outfits. The North Koreans also believe that the Japanese stole time from them during their occupation in 1919. And so Kim Jong-un set North Korea's clocks back by half an hour in 2015 to right this injustice. And Kim Jong-il's official biography says that he never needed to use a toilet because his body never needed to defecate. It was so well calibrated.
I love it. It's the sort of thing that we whisper about the Queen, but there'd never be an imperial edict about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right, Ben. I bet you that. I mean, I remember...
The Queen brings her own toilet seat with her.
What, like my four-year-old?
Not in her handbag. It's not like a Mary Poppins travelling bag. Standard lamp, umbrella, toilets. No, but when she travels places, apparently a new toilet seat gets fixed to the toilet that she will be using.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's strong Kim energy, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's the story that she always says that places everywhere. Big Kim energy. But she always says that when she goes places, they smell of fresh paint.
Yes,
you know, everywhere she's going has just been spruced up. I was with someone recently who said they were at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich a while ago, and the Queen was visiting later that day. And genuinely, they saw people out spray painting the grass green. Like there were brown patches and patches where it had gotten dry, and they wanted to make it. Now, you know, if the Queen is visiting, chances are there's going to be a lot of photos. You want your place to look your best, but it is a little bit Kim Jong-il can't shit in its vibes.
They also, the North Koreans also believe that Kim Jong-il's birthday is a national holiday around the world.
Yes, that they get celebrated in other countries.
Yeah, which is really, truly, truly odd. Yeah, a friend of mine does lighting for events and things like that, and he was at an event in Buckingham Palace, up in the rigging, you know, putting out whatever they do, and somebody comes running in and goes, quick, everybody come down. And a tray appeared with some glasses of champagne on it, and everyone was given a glass of champagne. It's not very sensible when you're rigging lights in an event. But anyway, and then the Queen sort of came in and, like, went up and said, oh, who are you? What do you do? So I'm Patrick, and I do the light. Okay, and moved on. And he said, what a weird experience. You know, everywhere you go, everybody's standing upright, staring at you, holding a glass of champagne, and nobody quite knows what to say. You know, almost a sort of Midas touch existence of people, I would imagine. Yeah.
It's, to be, I mean, because apparently the Queen is, you know, is pretty good at rapport. But I guess if you're the Queen, do you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, I was reading all the stories about Paul McCartney a couple of weeks ago, and about how he likes to be in control of people meeting him, and he's aware that people are going to remember this experience for the rest of their lives. So he wants to make sure that he lives up to what he is. But there's very much a difference between Beatle Paul and him being a bloke Paul. The Queen must have that awareness about her. Or do you think that it's just that she is so high status, she's like, I'm the Queen, bitches, deal with it.
Someone told a story about her during the Jubilee celebrations recently, that she was out walking in, you know, Scotland, in one of the estates where she often walks, and met some American tourists. This was in the last 20 years, who were hiking as well. And it seems the Americans didn't immediately recognise her, and they were, you know, they had I think they'd set up a campsite and they were just having some tea or biscuits or whatever, a picnic. And, you know, the Queen came by and they ended up chatting and they were saying, do you live around here? And she says, oh, I'm usually here in the summer and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, offered her a biscuit. And then they're like, and do you, oh, the Queen, they said the Queen lives around here, doesn't they? They say, oh yeah, she lives over there. And then at the end, they were. She was going to go, and she said, "Will I take a photo of us?" And they said, "Oh yeah, let's all have a photo." And so they all had a photo taken of themselves. She said, "I think she was with a private secretary of hers." And as she walked off, she said, "I can't wait for them to get back and show that to their friends."
Yeah. I mean, listen, I like both of you. I have great problems with the notion of a monarchy, but it's nice that she's having a bit of fun with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you may as well enjoy it.
I like that the Queen did a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Joviality. Yeah, I was commissioned to write her, you're not meant to talk about this, but I will. I was commissioned to write her obituary a few months ago, just in case, and I won't say who for or whatever, but a fairly large publication asked me to write her obituary. Obituaries have a code of honour where they never talk about it. It's like ghostwriters; they never talk about it.
Well, if an obituary writer is what you do before you become a ghostwriter, surely.
Beautifully, beautifully executed.
Anyway,
the thing was, it was really hard. Because I wanted to write an obituary about who she really was. And there's nothing. You can't find anything about her private life. It's so closely guarded, her privacy, beyond the Queen, that you don't know basic things like what she likes to eat or what her favourite music is. It's all very, very carefully managed. It's strange. It was a difficult challenge, that.
Yeah, I'll bet. I mean, I guess because she's such an obvious public figure, she wants to keep that to herself. But do you think that will come out maybe in 30, 50 years?
The Queen, you'd love to dance to Kajagoogoo, and her favourite food was Starburst.
Yeah, precisely. I wanted to start by talking about founding fathers. Obviously, the most famous founding fathers in history are the gentleman who started the United States of America, but I had a little look through to see if there were any others who had interesting backstories. And I would like you gentlemen to tell me if you know who one of the two founding fathers of Chile was. This is aimed particularly at you, Barry.
Simon Bolivar?
It's not Simon Bolivar.
No, there's an Irish guy. There's an Irish guy who helped found their navy. Is that right?
Yeah, so you've got Jose Miguel Carrera and Bernardo O'Higgins.
That's right, Bernardo O'Higgins, yeah.
Which I was not expecting at all when I was scrolling through stuff about South America. So his full name is Bernardo O'Higgins Riquelme, and he is the illegitimate son of a chap called Ambrosio O'Higgins, who is a Spanish officer born in County Sligo. And he went on to become governor of Chile and later viceroy of Peru. And his mother was Isabel Riquelme, who was a prominent local. His father, Ambrosio, sounds like a fairly awful person. O'Higgins was sent to Lima by his father at the age of 15 and was supported financially by his dad. But basically, after that, the two never met again. In person. I'm not going to take you through a blow-by-blow of the Chilean Revolution, but it was just... because we neither have the time nor the inclination, but there was a couple of apparently famous quotes that he said during key moments of the conflict. And my favourite is him going, "Lads, live with honour or die with glory. He who is brave, follow me." And I just love a key revolutionary figure starting a quote with, "Lads!"
Yeah.
Like he's a Dublin boy on a night out.
Yeah.
There is a bust of O'Higgins in London, in Richmond, by the bridge. And every year, the mayor of Richmond is joined by members of the Chilean embassy to lay a wreath there. There's a blue plaque at Clarence House in Richmond. There is also a plaque in his honour at Merrion Square in Dublin.
Yes.
And on the Garavogue Walkway in Sligo. There is also a football club named after him, O'Higgins Football Club in Chile, based in Rancagua, which has existed since 1945 and has a former manager, Manuel Pellegrini.
Ah, cool.
So they're a proper club. I wish that they played in green, white and gold, but they don't. They play in Uruguayan pale blue.
Yeah, fair enough.
Next up, we've talked before about Brendan the Navigator, haven't we, Barry?
Yes, Irish monk who was said to have reached North America in a Curragh Irish open rowing boat in the 600s, I think.
Have you chaps heard about Madog Ab Owen Gwynedd?
Is he the Welsh version?
Essentially, yes. He is the Welsh version who apparently sailed to America in 1170. Yeah, and this story, it clearly evolved out of a medieval tradition about a Welsh hero sea voyage, but it became hugely popular again in the Elizabethan era to sort of give England a claim to North America. whilst everyone was... Oh, not that you needed a claim, because the Spanish and Portuguese just turned up and went, good day, lovely feathers, this is ours now.
Yeah.
The most fascinating thing about it is that the story remained popular after the Elizabethan age, and there began to be a narrative that emerged that not only did Madoc discover America, but his voyagers intermarried with the local Native Americans, and that there were Welsh-speaking descendants living somewhere in the United States. And these stories of Welsh Indians abounded. So there was a notion that some of them lived around the Devil's Backbone in Kentucky, which is... The Devil's Backbone is a series of ridges or stones that stand out. There are the Welsh Caves in northeastern Alabama. And my favourite there's one from 1810 in Tennessee, and a chap called John Sevier, who was the first governor of there, talks about a conversation he had about 30 years earlier with a Cherokee chief about some ancient fortifications, and the chief told him that those forts were built by white people who he called the Welsh. And Sevier had even written that there was an apparent discovery of six skeletons in brass armour nearby bearing the Welsh coat of arms. And there is a similar story written by a chap called Thomas S. Hind, who is the editor of the American Pioneer, who again talks about these six soldiers being dug up, this time in Jeffersonville, Indiana, and they had a Welsh coat of arms on their uniform. This story even reached the presidency. In 1804, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to a chap called Meriwether Lewis, and he speaks of searching for the Welsh Indians said to be up the Missouri. Some historians believe that he even instructed Lewis and Clark on their expedition to go and find the Madoc Welsh Indians.
I've got a really, as you speak, I've got a really weird theory about that, which I have got no evidence to back up. And this is just me throwing something out there.
Okay.
The origin of the term Welsh is from Germanic people describing other people as foreigners.
Yes.
And that's why in Switzerland, the Swiss Germans call the Swiss French die Welsch. And the Dutch Belgians call the French Belgians the Walloons, which is very similar, which I think is derived from the same name. Is it just about possible that at some point some Germanic people or this is just a crazy theory, started describing the Native American Indians as the Welsh?
That is some really good on the hoof etymological digging around in the dirt. Oh, I like that a lot. Yeah.
Yep. Mystery solved.
One last thing in America, I try to find the stupidest founding father. I feel like we've talked about this chap before. Barry, have we chatted about Gouverneur Morris?
That name rings a bell. Gouverneur isn't a first name you forget easily.
No. So he was known as the penman of the Constitution because he just had a beautiful writing style. He is the person right. who came up with the phrase, "We the people of the United States," which, you know, has got a nice melody
wow.
to it.
what an innovator. Mr. Yeah. Shakespeare over here.
He was quite a fan of the ladies. But the thing I want to talk about is his death. He suffered from crippling gout, and the pain grew worse and worse, and he began to experience a blockage in his urinary tract. Now, this being 1816, and a time when medicine was at best experimental, he attempted to use he attempted to self-catheterize using a piece of whalebone.
Yes, that's right. Now I don't remember who this guy is.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and it didn't work and he died to the end.
He shoved a whalebone up his dick.
Yes, and thus that is why he is not on the $5 note.
Yeah.
Or Mount Ridgemore. Or whatever.
Yeah.
Ridgemore.
Next we go to Greece. Now, this is right on the borderline between national myth and conspiracy theory, but I discovered something called the Epsilon Team. Now, this is I know
it was
it's...
a Power Rangers offshoot, wasn't it?
Yeah, it does. It was someone ordered the Krypton Factor off Wish.com, and that's what they got. They were an alleged secret society that appears in a lot of modern folklore, conspiracy theories, and you'll be unsurprised to know a lot of anti-Semitism. Their notion is that a lot of prominent Greek people possessed secret knowledge which was of extraterrestrial origin. So far, so bog standard conspiracy theory. Where did this extraterrestrial knowledge come from? Well, the author of this mythology is a chap called George Lefkofridis, and he developed a notion that there were hidden messages in Aristotle's Organon, and the reason was because Aristotle was an alien from the star system Mu. That's Mu. That's not from. Aristotle is not an intergalactic cow.
The original cow who jumped over the moon, Aristotle.
Cows in space, not pigs in space.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's great about this is that he then presented the Greeks being of extraterrestrial origin, particularly the Olympian gods. And he basically. Clearly took a leaf out of L. Ron Hubbard's book, and his cosmology appears to be that the Olympian gods are one set of extraterrestrials who are battling the Jewish god, who is also an extraterrestrial.
Right.
So all I'm saying is I want to see the musical of this on ice.
Yeah. The musical. Except it's spelled the same, so no one will realise the pun is there.
Yes. Oh, God, yes. But for my nomination of the world's worst national myth, we're going to go to Turkey. Now, briefly, I want to tell you about what appears to be a Turkish riff on Romulus and Remus. So there is a mythological figure called Asena, who is a she-wolf. And she is the ancestress of the Gokturks. And there is a wolf tale that tells of a young boy who survived a battle. A female wolf found this injured child and nursed him back to health. So far, Sir Romulus and Remus. The she-wolf then becomes impregnated by the boy, escapes her enemies by crossing the Western Sea to a cave up in some mountains and a city, and gives birth to 10 half-wolf, half-human boys. And of these, one of them becomes the leader and establishes the Asena clan, which then rules over other clans in this Turkic area. Essentially, we got ourselves some werewolves here, guys.
Mm-hmm. Nice. The Turkish werewolves.
The Turkish werewolves.
I do like a Turkish werewolf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the national myth I want to talk about is the sun language theory. Now, this was propagated in the early 1930s when Turkey had only just got its statehood and Kemal Atatürk was doing his best to set that all in stone. And this is 100% pseudoscience, pseudo-linguistics. But the notion is that, according to the theory, Central Asian sun worshippers who wanted to salute the omnipotence of the sun and all of its qualities did so by transforming their meaningless blabbering into a coherent state of ritualistic language, thus creating all language everywhere. And so, because Turkey is, you know, it's the classic east-west country, but because it is the bridge between the steppe people who went all the way out to East China and who also then went into Europe, there is the notion that this is the language, this is the basis of Proto-Indo-European.
Okay. I don't hate it.
There is there was a mother language theory kicking around and has kind of kicked, it's not as bonkers as that, I hasten to add, but one which kind of suggests that there was a mother language. Unfortunately, it's all wrapped up in the Aryan stuff, which is racist.
Yes. Mm. Well,
out of that well of utter weirdness that you've just described.
So this basically popped up in the 30s. Atatürk liked the thought of it. He gave some money to study it. But by the time we get to 1942 and the Turkish Language Congress, it had completely disappeared. However, friends, you'll be unsurprised to know this has reared its head again under our friend Recep Erdogan.
Yeah, of course. Atatürk, genuinely one of the underestimated figures of the 20th century, I think, like quite a progressive guy for the early half of the 20th century. Someone founding a state. There's not a lot of great ones, but he's one of the good ones. And then you come 100 years later, you've got a moron like Erdogan, who probably able to sue me for calling him a moron now.
Yeah, probably. Well, I'd like to hope we're outside of his jurisdiction.
Yeah. So, no, he does this, doesn't he? Hasn't he sued people? They passed a law where you can sue people overseas for insulting him.
I will take your word for it and choose my words carefully.
So if you did enjoy listening to us in Turkey, we've dropped off Spotify in Turkey now.
So basically, he has taken the notion that Turkey is the crucible of all languages a step further and said that Turkey is the crucible of all culture. And obviously, you have those. It's easy for him to do this in some ways because there is Turkey, the country, and the Turkic group of peoples, which makes up like the Uyghur people and the Kyrgyz people, the Kazakhstani people, and so obviously these are all peoples who are finding their feet after the fall of the Soviet Union. But Erdogan has suggested, amongst other things, that Turkish Muslim pilgrims discovered America several centuries before Christopher Columbus. Proof of this.
Everyone has to have one. Everyone has to have a We Discovered America story.
Yeah. His proof is that apparently in Columbus's memoirs, there is mentioned the existence of a mosque atop a hill on the coast of Cuba. That is not true. This notion has now spread into other countries that are part of the Turkish people. So you have a headline in Kazakhstan's largest news agency in the past few years came up with, "Jesus Christ was a Kazakh. Not a single scholar has refuted his point."
And yet, as I was saying about North Korea, we laugh. And yet, you know, and did those feet in ancient...
Yeah. Yes, of course.
That's the long myth about Thomas Aquinas bringing Jesus to Somerset. And I read a lengthy thing the other day that was really... It was our friend Neil Oliver, I think.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Now of GB News, made a podcast about, you know, there might be something in it. There's nothing.
Thomas Aquinas and Jesus, famously contemporaries.
Yes. Well, they could...
Jack that, Jesus.
Barry, yeah. You have hit on something remarkable there, because they might have been, according to the final piece of this puzzle, Anatoly Fomenko, who is a renowned mathematician and a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And he is building on all this notion of the Sun Empire and the great Turco-Slavic Empire, Great Tartary, and this notion that it's not just that Russia have been painted as the bad guys throughout history, but that Russia has actually been undervalued as a historical force. And so this alternate picture that he's given, Columbus, Russian, Jesus, Russian, Moses, Russian. And in fact, a millennia of history has been faked by Normans and Polish Jesuit priests. Some of his chronology includes the fact that Jesus lived in the 12th century AD, so pals with Thomas Aquinas, and was crucified on Joshua's Hill, which I believe is in Russia. The Trojan War and the Crusades are the same historical event. Genghis Khan and the Mongols were actually Russians. The lands west of the 13 colonies in America were actually a far eastern part of the Siberian American Empire prior to its disintegration in 1775. And the kind of scary thing is, this guy has the ear of Vladimir Putin.
Mm.
Up to and including the fact that he got backing by from another oligarch called Vadim Yakunin for an entire museum dedicated to this falsified Russian history. And all of this, it comes from the seed of the Sun language theory in Turkey.
Oh,
right.
What a strand. What a strand right. That was.
For all of those reasons, because, mine is a national myth that dominoed out of all perspective, I'm going to go for the Sun language theory. So our nominations for the world's worst national myth are Barry's nomination of the formation of the Republic of Ireland, which appears to have been a bit of banter that got out of hand. Otto's suggestion of three generations of incredibly inventive bullshit all formed on Mount Pictou in North Korea. And my nomination of the Turkic Sun language theory that everything ultimately is Turkish. Well, we've managed to go all around the globe, lads. I think it's a straight fist fight between me and Otto, to be perfectly honest. I like yours, Barry, I do, but it's less a bad national myth and more to someone getting a bit overexcited and jumping the gun.
Yeah, if it was the story that John A. Costello's body is so perfect that he couldn't shit at this meal and declared the country a republic, might have had more of a chance.
Yeah, I'm so tough, because I mean, mine is basically a bit of academic narcissism run wild, whereas Otto's is it's so mad and it's so iconically mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I can't see past North Korea, because ultimately, like we've spoken about already, the Turkic Sun language has given us nothing other than a slight paranoia about the extension of Russian soft power. Whereas Otto, yours has given us the greatest comedy film of the 21st century. So I think I'm going to have to give this one to you, my friend.
Or as somebody from the intelligence services once said to me, the greatest documentary ever made. and that is a true story. The guy was genuinely a source. Genuinely from the intelligence services genuinely said that to me, yeah.
Love it. Just before we go, I'm going to give you the best news of the week to keep our heads up in these end times. For this, we're going to Morristown, Tennessee, where Lindsay Russell, who worked there, heard a strange noise coming from a Pepsi vending machine. She went to investigate and found a tiny grey kitten had somehow got lodged inside the vending machine. Luckily,
I would have spent pound after pound trying to get that out. I'd be stood there with a handful of Twixes and packets of cheese crackers going, I'm coming for you. B4, B4, B4.
Thankfully, the Morristown Fire Department are more enterprising than you, Barry. And I'd love to tell you that they got an enormous sledgehammer out and just destroyed the screen. But no, they just removed a few panels of the machine and teased the kitten out. And In true superhero style, a firefighter said, if we can help save a life, animal or human, we'll do what we can do.
Oh. Does the kitten now have some like iconic name?
Oh,
like based on the fact that they were in a vending machine?
Gosh, I don't know. I didn't find that. They should do, shouldn't they? Should
be called. Are they grey? So they're a grey kitten.
Mm-hmm. They should be called Twinkie, surely.
Probably actually healthier to eat a grey kitten than it is to eat a Twinkie.
A lot of protein on those things. Before we go, Otto, where can our listeners find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Well, you know, I'm everywhere like a heat rash, unfortunately, on Twitter. And obviously my book is in all good bookshops and the usual social media, usual evil platforms that sell books on this planet.
Smashing stuff, where we'll all offer a quick 18 holes of mind golf until next time. See you later. Bye bye.